think you can get non-uniform field. If I buy a Cadillac brand, let me drop. The Cadillac brand is going to be making a magnetizing circuit that has an air gap that's exactly equal to the height of the thing that they want to magnetize. So that when they place it in there, there is no air gap. And the rod on the left side and the rod on the right side are the exact same diameter, and maybe they should be the exact same diameter as the thing that you're magnetizing. And now I can get a uniform field through that neodymium magnet. So if I do it quick and dirty, and I don't bother readjusting the gap, I can see a mechanism by which I have greater concentration on the north side, lesser concentration on the south side. The total magnetic field is the same. The total magnetic field is the same, but where the lines of force fall are very different on the left side versus the right side. Do you see where I'm going in that one, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yes, I do, Dick, but if we look at the continuity of that force, everything leaving the North Pole is going to be returning to the South Pole, so the density is going to be the same, would it not?
Oh, hold on now. What's your definition of density? If my lines of force are all very close to the axis, very close to the center of the disk on the left-hand side, and they're much further from the center of the disk on the right-hand side, same number of lines, but they're exiting the right-hand side in a more mushroom-like manner. They're flaring out. They're flaring out more on the right-hand side at the point of exit of the magnet compared to the left-hand side. Same number of lines, but they're not uniformly flowing through the center. In other words, the majority of the lines flowing through the center of the magnet are not parallel to the axis. They're all tilted away from the axis as they go to the right-hand side. I'm not violating the number of magnetic lines. I'm just telling you the different places by which they're entering and exiting that disc-shaped object. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, I understand exactly what you're saying. But then again, if all of those magnetic lines are returning, even though they're returning to an off-centered point, we still have the same magnetic strength if the field density is the same. So why would that change how it slides down the aluminum? The level of magnetism is there, and the weight hasn't changed, so the effect should be the same.
Don't agree. If I now pick up this non-uniform magnet...
2 meter... transmit.
I now pick up this magnet that has this non-uniform field that you and I just described. And instead of putting it flat against a chunk of steel, if I put it flat against a chunk of steel and I have north side in or south side in, I might be measuring pretty close to the same amount of retention force. However, if instead of putting it flat against a piece of steel, I decide to pick up a rod of steel that is, let me pick a number, a quarter of an inch in diameter. I put the quarter inch diameter rod right in the center of the axis on the left-hand side, and I measure how many pounds of force it takes to extract it. I take the exact same rod, an unmagnetized rod, I put it in the center of the axis of the right-hand side, and I measure the number of pounds of force required to extract it. I'll get a considerably lower number of pounds on the right-hand side because the concentration of the magnetic lines of force at the axis on the right-hand side is a lower concentration. As the magnetic lines flow through my magnet, they are spreading out away from the axis. Therefore, the number of lines per quarter of an inch on the right-hand side is a lower number, and therefore the holding force on the right-hand side is a lower number. Do you see where I'm going on that one, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Oh, absolutely, Dick. I understand completely what you're saying. So if we were to lay it flat against a piece of steel and we use a spring scale, the pull-off tension would be identical. But with the sliding on the aluminum, you say that would be a different effect, correct?
You're jumping ahead. I'm picking up a smaller diameter rod, a quarter inch diameter rod using a 1 inch diameter magnet. On the left-hand side, I can have more lines of force. I can pick up the quarter-inch diameter rod on end. It's the end of the rod, quarter-inch diameter, going into the center of the left-hand side, right at the axis. Strong lines of force are concentrated there. I'll get a great big holding force. The same rod touching the axis of the right-hand side will give me a smaller amount of retaining force because the lines are less concentrated at the axis on the right-hand side. Do you see that so far? Go ahead.
Yes, I do, Dick, and that's why the Hall effect device that you'd use to detect that would read that difference, yes.
I agree with that. The Hall effect device on the right-hand side would read a lower number than the left-hand side, even though the total number of lines throughout the whole darn thing is the same. Now, because of those different distribution patterns of the magnetic lines of force against the aluminum and the method by which it creates eddy currents, you're going to get entirely different field of eddy currents when north is in versus south is in. Because you bought a high-quality neodymium magnet, which has uniform magnetic field throughout it, because there was no air gap when they put that into the magnetizing machine. You bought a Cadillac. That guy is demonstrating a Volkswagen. He bought Brand X, which was just sloppily thrown into a machine with an air gap. He's got this non-uniform magnetic field. Therefore, the north side has a different kind of eddy current pattern in the aluminum versus the south side. Therefore, it behaves differently in the way it holds itself against the aluminum. And now, the next level of why it jumps away is a little bit more difficult to explain, but at least we've got a possible mechanism of difference. I'll go over the square magnet in a second, but let's stick with this one for a second. Do you see where I'm going on this one, John? K2RIW?
Oh, absolutely, Dick. And I do have enough magnets to... I only tried it with two magnets, and they both work identically. Maybe the whole group is going to be working that way, but I will find out. Because that was very interesting, and I noticed that the effect of a magnet sliding on aluminum last year when I was fooling around with them. And when I saw that, I was shocked because I didn't remember seeing that. So I purposely set up the project and did it again. Although I have to admit, I did not orientate it specifically to the cardinal points of the compass. My angle of elevation, which I tried almost completely vertical to maybe 30 degrees, I had it north-south orientation to the plane of the metal. Maybe it would work differently south, east-west, I don't know.
Now, the magnetic lines of force from the Earth are in the vicinity of 400 milligauss. Very, very weak magnetic field by comparison to these neodymium magnets. The neodymium magnet is thousands of times stronger than the Earth's magnetic field. So I think you can duplicate these experiments with your sheet of metal aimed toward the north, the south, the east, and the west. I don't think you're going to see a difference, because I think you're spitting in the ocean with Earth's magnetic field compared to what you're doing with this magnet. And now the magnetic distribution across the north face versus the south face sets up an entirely different set of rings of eddy currents as it slides across the aluminum, and that can create individual opposing and attracting areas, and therefore the magnet tends to jump away from the aluminum in his case. I suspect he bought Brand X of neodymium magnets. I suspect that all of your magnets were bought from the same brand name, and I'll bet you your brand name is a Cadillac brand name that didn't do that. I bet you they did a much nicer job, because when they've got these divergent magnetic fields, that means they didn't saturate the magnet. A saturated magnet probably wouldn't do that. I think theirs was only partially saturated, or only saturated on the left-hand side, the one that was touching the pole piece during the magnetizing process. That's what I think is going on. Now I'm going to go to the square one. The next experiment the guy did in that video is he took a rectangular-shaped magnet. It looked to me like it was, let me pick an inch, I'll pick a number. It looked like it was an inch and a half tall, or maybe an inch wide, and maybe a quarter of an inch thick. Those are the approximate dimensions of what I saw. And he said that this had a unique magnetization. It was magnetized where one pole was the upper right-hand corner. The other pole was the lower left-hand corner. Now when he takes this diagonally magnetized rectangular thing, and he presses it against the aluminum, and he lets go. With one particular experiment, it comes down and sweeps to the right. He then puts it back up to the top, flips it over front to back, and now he lets go of it, and it curves to the left when it goes down. That's the Hall effect.
One thing to pose addition to that is that that magnet, the narrow side of the rectangle, was representing south and north. The wider one was I don't know how to say it.
He pointed toward the corners. He said the magnetic field goes from the upper right-hand corner to the lower left-hand corner. He didn't say the word upper right-hand or lower left-hand. With his fingers were bridging that rectangular object across the diagonal, and he said it is magnetized across that angle. So in other words, the magnetic field was not parallel to any of the surfaces, any of the edges of this magnet. So it had a slanting magnetic field. Therefore, when you put it against the aluminum, in one case, the slanting magnetic field slants toward the right. When you flip it over, the slanting magnetic field slants to the left. Therefore, the eddy currents that created as it swept across the aluminum, by way of something like the Hall effect, gave you this left-hand deflection and right-hand deflection. What he is demonstrating, in my opinion, is something similar to the Hall effect. In the case of the Hall effect, you've got a bar of resistive material. You've got a current flowing from across the long dimension of the bar. The magnetic field that is at right angles to the bar creates a deflection such that a voltage-sensing device from top to bottom of the bar, so to speak. The bar is left to right in my diagram, and I'm putting current across the longest dimension of the bar. But at right angles to the longest dimension, I've got two probes that are picking up a voltage. And now the current ordinarily flows down the center of the bar. Let me drop. But by Lenz's law, whenever a moving charge is at right angles to a magnetic field, by the right-hand rule, the charge experiences a force, a deflecting force. So as you apply a magnetic field to that Hall effect device, the deflection of the current flow through the long dimension of the bar makes a differential voltage across the two probes that are on the short dimension of the bar. That's Hall effect. And so this diagonally magnetized magnet sliding across the aluminum is displaying a kind of eddy current, kind of an eddy current Hall effect phenomena that's deflecting it to one side or the other is a guess on my part. I don't know which one wants to pick that up. KQRIW.
But Dick, I think he also said it always favored the south. Did you pick that up?
I saw it deflect to the right with one orientation. When he flipped it over, it deflected to the left. And once again, Earth's magnetic field is going to be so much smaller than the field from these neodymium magnets. Whether he's got his sheet of metal oriented toward north, south, east, or west is, in my opinion, arbitrary. Over to you, John.
No, I believe he said the deflection as it's coming down always favored the south pole of the magnet. So when he flipped it around, it went the other way following the south pole. I believe that's what he said, but then, from what I remember. I looked at it yesterday.
What I recall is it was either going to the south, either going to the north. We don't know what was the orientation for the sheet, but yeah, that's what Dick says. Sounds reasonable. Entourage.
I'm talking about the compass points. I was talking about the magnetic points.
Yeah, the upper right-hand corner, we're going to call it north. The lower left-hand corner, I'm going to call it south. And now when you flip it over, south is either the lower left-hand corner or the lower right-hand corner when you flip it over. So you could say it always favors south. Therefore, it's always going to curve in the direction of where that corner is. If that's what he's saying, when it always favors south, and recognizing that south is a diagonal magnetization on that magnet, then I think it makes some sense. So I think he's demonstrating the Hall effect. What do you think, John?
I think you might be right, Dick. I don't have a magnet like that to try it, but I will get one, because I'm interested to see how that effect takes place. But it sounds very interesting. That whole experiment was interesting to me. And tough to realize that magnetic field would be that disproportionate to cause that to happen. So I'll have to try to find some of those.
John, do you own some kind of a Hall effect device by which you can measure the strength of the magnetic field of your particular magnet?
I have one. I can borrow. I can lend it to John if he wants to make an experiment. I have the Gauss meter 912 Gauss meter by RFL.
I bet you already have some kind of a Gauss meter, don't you, John?
Yes, I do, Dick.
And will it go? What's the maximum magnetic field do you think it can tolerate?
I'm not sure of that, but I'm sure it could read these small neodymium magnets that I have, even though they're extremely strong. This thing can be used in pretty heavy magnetization fields.
Yeah, the only thing I would worry about is whether or not you saturate your probe, and in which case you can always get a different probe for your machine that will tolerate a stronger field before saturation. On top of that, there's ways you can build a shield around your probe. Therefore, you could multiply its reading, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John.
Yes, I believe they make a copper sleeve that goes on the probe, which attenuates it a certain amount. I thought I remember reading that in the instruction booklet, but I don't have one. But I could get one.
Yeah, copper itself, to my knowledge, does not deflect the magnetic field, does not attenuate, doesn't do anything to a magnetic field as long as it's a steady state magnetic field. So therefore the copper sleeve, I'm going to guess, is simply a spacer device. It's an inert spacer. Therefore the field you measure will be a lower number because you're measuring at a greater distance. The good news is that you can now measure a stronger local field. The bad news is now you're getting a little bit less resolution of the fine detail of the local magnetic field as you sweep from axis out to the perimeter of your magnet to find out the rate at which it falls off. And because all of your magnets were made by the same manufacturer and hopefully were done with no air gap during the magnetizing process, I think you're going to find the north side and the south side are going to be fairly uniform, just opposite in polarity. Whereas I think he had a big difference there. One of the next things that Wesley had in one of his email type videos was what happens when you've got a spark gap in a magnetic field and you see the spark gap rotating around the axis of this point source type spark plug. You got a spark plug where it's got a point coming out of the center and the spark jumps from the center out to the perimeter, and when you do that in a magnetic field, the spark, let me drop, the spark will continuously rotate. Very similar to what was done with the arc transmitters of, let me pick a number, 1915. In the case of an arc transmitter running, 100 kilowatt type numbers, where ordinarily you're going to be eating up your contacts real fast, by putting the arc in an inert gas inside of a strong magnetic field, the arc would propagate around the probe in a similar manner to that video. Therefore, you weren't eating up one particular corner of the electrode. Therefore, your electrodes ran cooler, lasted longer, and the whole process was more efficient or more reliable. So, and that really is again the Lenz's law being demonstrated. The arc is a moving current in the plasma that really is the spark gap, the arc, and that current, which is moving electrons in the magnetic field, are experiencing a right angle deflection. That right angle deflection moves the spark around the circle in a fairly rapid manner. I wonder if you saw that one video, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Lenz's law, Lorentz forces.
WGB. Yes, I did see that video, Dick. And that works very similar as blowout coils on the heavy current switches and switches that we used in industry. Those magnetic blowout coils extinguish the arc, and the magnetic field is just pushing it up. Yep. I've seen that video, and it works well.
Yeah, I may have chosen the wrong guy's name. It may be Lorentz instead of Lorentz, but you know what I mean. one of those famous guys told you the so-called right angle rule, where a magnetic field and a current flow and a force. Over to you, Wes, N2XJN, KQRIW.
Well, I see here possibly Lorentz forces, but the thing is that when I was looking for possible answers and all of the responses to that video, nobody found really the answer for it. One of the most radical explanation for it, because I sent you two different videos by two different guys showing the rotation, is that if we compare to what you said about 1915 transmitter, and here we're dealing with the circumferential configuration. You have a pinion side, and you have the outer edge, which is the circle, around the pin of the spark gap. So basically, the spark cannot hit one part of it or edge for it. There is no edge, and there is a rotation. And that's what puzzles me. Before I go further with the radicality of it, back to you.
Okay, what part of that was puzzling you, Wes? The fact that the spark moved around the circle? Go ahead.
Yes, well, when you were describing 1915, you were talking that it would hit one side of the contact. Oh, yeah. But now we have a situation in which we have a spark up. We cut the L-shaped pin, and we have just rotating the inner pin, and then we have a circle around it. Those are the two electrodes. All of a sudden, we have now the circulation of the spark. So the spark, if there was a spark transmitter, couldn't hit any edge of it because there is no sharp edge on it. But at the same time, there is no reference point for the spark go to the particular direction. So I don't really know whether I could apply the Lorentz forces in here. Definitely we're not dealing with the Lenz law in here.
You can buy a kind of a spark plug that really looks like a coaxial cable. That from the high voltage probe on the outside of the porcelain, there is a rod going down the center, and the rod suddenly stops. The outer perimeter, the grounded portion, is the other electrode. They didn't put the L-shaped object in there. So there's a kind of spark plug you can buy that is built exactly that way. Or you could take one that's built the other way and modify it by grinding away the L-shaped object. So we can make a spark plug look like a piece of the end of a coax cable. That's what he's done here. Now, you do have a current flowing during that arc. In one particular polarity, it's flowing from center toward the perimeter. And as that current flows, there is a magnetic field where the lines of magnetic field are parallel to the center rod of the spark plug. So now you've got a spark going from center to perimeter. Call it from the center of the clock to the 12 o'clock position on the very first beginning of the spark. You've got a magnetic field that's coming straight out of the center of the clock. They're at right angles. A force is created. The electrons are being deflected either toward the clockwise direction, toward 1 o'clock or toward 11 o'clock, depending on polarities. And that force pushes the electrons that want to move from center pin to the perimeter, pushes them either in a clockwise. So once you accept the right-hand rule, the fact that it's going to move in the circle seems to be a given. And by the way, this is not too different from what happens inside of a magnetron. If you study the magnetic field, the center probe and the outer perimeter resonators that you've got in a magnetron tube, there's a strong similarity here. In either case, a current flow is pushing the magnetic field so that it walks around the circle. N2XJN, KQLIW.
Come in.
Go ahead, John.
Wes, it's not circumferential. That is a radial displacement on that arc. And if you reverse the magnet, you will reverse direction. That's how it works.
I have a problem with this because one magnet in one video was a toroidal magnet, and the spark was inside of that. The other video was that there was a cylindrical magnet that was actually the certain pin of it. And I still don't understand the direction. That means, if I look at the lens law, I could not really specify which direction it would go to. And to actually...
Well, Wesley, if you brought a magnet, a regular bar magnet, next to an arc, it will deflect. You can do that in your lab. You can see that right away. Dick, over to you, sir.
Oh, yeah, I can do that. But I'm not going to have a circulation end to end. There was one of the videos that I put in here which has a U-shaped tube that shows the plasma and the plasma deflection on it. So by that token, we don't see with the presence of the plasma to that U-shaped bulb, and we see the plasma inside the bulb, we don't see the circulation, although we put the magnet in it. Enter again.
Yeah, in those two videos, there were two entirely different ways of setting up the magnet. That's not a showstopper. As long as there is a component of magnetic field at right angles to the spark, you will get this deflection. Just the sum of the magnetic field is at right angles to the spark. It doesn't have to all be. Then you're going to get the deflection. The only thing that's bothering me a little bit is that the spark that they were creating, if they were doing it with a high voltage DC, I have no problem. If they were doing it with something like a Tesla coil, which makes AC, you've now got each half of the cycle of what's coming out of the Tesla coil, call it positive and then negative, which means you're reversing the direction of the electron flow. Therefore, you're reversing whether or not the spark is going to propagate clockwise or counterclockwise. And so, if on each half cycle you're reversing, you would think the spark would just wiggle back and forth and not get a chance to go all the way around. But there's a catch. The catch is, and I see it coming, if I put positive voltage on the center pin, it takes a much higher voltage before I get a breakdown. If I put negative voltage on the center pin, it will break down at a much lower voltage. Therefore, that spark gap, because of the non-symmetry of the pin and the perimeter, the grounded perimeter, so to speak, is a kind of a rectifier. There's going to be more current flow in one direction than the other. Therefore, the average force is going to be, let's say, clockwise. So even with AC, with that particular configuration, I think we're still going to get circumferential propagation. See what John thinks about this. KC2W...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KC2WGB, K2RW. Go ahead, John.
Very good point, Dick. I believe you're right in that case. However, I think the high voltage they were using, if I'm not mistaken, was from a flyback, which is an IVT, and that, and the model ones, and that's a DC voltage. And it didn't arc like an AC arc. It looked like a DC arc, if you've seen the difference.
Yes, I have, and I agree with you. Back to you, Wes.
Yeah. Going to go shortly to the next video, which was the U-shaped bulb, and they put the magnet into it. There was a sign of the deflection of the plasma inside that U-shaped bulb, but there was no sign of circulation. And then we go to magnetic levitation over the copper. Back to you, Dick.
I saw the that arc inside that tube rotating. I don't know if you saw it, Dick.
Right now my machine is not loading for some reason. Is this the Marcos dancing magnet or is the next one after that?
Sparking, hold on, let me open up so I know which one we're talking about. The name of it, Spark in Spiral Magnetic Field. Spark in Spiral Magnetic Field. And this is U-shaped light bulb with two electrodes, and he put a magnet next to it. And to actually...
Yeah, Dick, it looks like a xenon flash tube.
Yeah, the name of that video is Spark in Spiral Magnetic Field.
Okay, I see the U-shaped neon bulb, and it's a two-minute video. And is he about to bring a magnet nearby?
Yes, he will.
Do you believe the voltage he's putting across that neon tube is AC or DC, John?
Not sure, Dick. It looks like AC to me.
Yeah, it looks like AC to me also, because you tend to get a Thompson effect. In other words, a blue glow on the cathode versus the anode. And as I see him now put the neodymium magnet in various positions, and he can create various kinds of instability. Again, I think it is a similar deflection. The method by which you get electronic deflection inside of a cathode ray tube, I think each one of these is displaying something fairly similar to that. KQLIW?
The thing is that he never put on the side of that U-shaped magnet for us to see how it would react. But I don't see circulation. I'm trying to have a distinction between that what we spoke right before that video and that what we see right now on that video.
Dick, do you see a swirling effect?
I sure do. With certain ways that he holds the magnet, it is my belief that the discharge is moving in a manner that is tracing out a cylinder of charge flowing through that thing. I think it's in some cases walking across the perimeter of the glass. If you took a cross section of the glass near the magnet, if you know what I mean, I think it's making a complete cylindrical current flow in some of those cases. Isn't that what you see also, John?
Yes, Dick, that's what I believe. My eyes lead me to believe exactly what you're seeing. I see a swirling effect, and what's causing that? Okay, it's basically the same thing, I believe.
So when you see the concentration of the plasma, you see the swirling effect, John. Dick.
You said, when I see the concentration of the plasma, I'll see this effect. Tell me which video I should be viewing to see what you just said.
Please understand that the U-shaped video, we've seen before the circulating plasma. Now, on this video, when you have a U-shape, and he put the magnet in it, do you see the swirling effect on that part of the concentration of plasma due to the magnetic field?
The way a traveling wave tube works is that you have a magnetic field flowing down the axis of the helix, and the magnetic field is essentially parallel to the flow of electrons, in which case any of those electrons that decide to deviate from going down the center of the helix start taking on a little bit of an angle with reference to the magnetic field, and they eventually end up moving in a spiral manner. So as he orients that magnet in various ways, there is a component of the magnetic field that's parallel to the arc. There's a component of the magnetic field that's perpendicular to the arc. So he's getting some very complicated patterns there at times. He's sometimes tracing out a tubular, a current surface. Other times he's tracing out other kinds of instability in which it's jumping around in some very crazy ways. And so I think what the arc is trying to instantaneously extinguish itself, but there's a high enough voltage to reestablish it, and so you get a kind of a oscillation going on. That's what I think he's seeing, but I'm not sure. KQRIW.
Okay, and fix it. The next video is magnetic levitation over the copper, and related to that, diamagnetically stabilized levitation over the copper. I think that you've seen that, so you can explain better how is that being done to the audience, Dick. John, maybe you can describe that. Magnetic levitation over the copper, and the second video, there, magnetically stabilized levitation of the copper. I can only say what is the description for it. This video demonstrates they are magnetically stabilized levitation over the copper, a large Lichter magnet, not visible on that video, that is on the top, attracts a teeny one millimeter magnet. At the small scale, and due to the field geometry of larger Lichter magnet, the weak magnetism of copper is sufficient for holding the teeny cube magnet. And there is more explanation for it, but John?
Yeah, when Dick watches it, he'll make his comments. I didn't get a chance to see that one, Liz. And Dick, if you do get a chance, you said you had some comments on my Canon Center. Maybe you could take 2 minutes out.
Yeah, I'm going to go to those videos. Yeah, I've seen a number of these levitation experiments, and they're very beautiful looking. And they fall into two different versions. One version, you bring a strong magnet near a superconducting surface, and you get a locked magnetic field, so to speak, and the thing sits in space. You can move it to a new position, and it moves to a new space. That's one kind of levitation. There's another kind of levitation machine you can buy, which really is a servo mechanism. By one means or another, it senses the location of the magnet, and it instantaneously increases or decreases an electromagnet somewhere in order to not allow it to jump to one side or the other. So there's at least two different kinds of levitation. Ordinarily, it's very difficult, as I see it, to make something passively levitate and stay in one spot. I think that's very difficult. I believe it's been done, but I think it's difficult. I think the servo mechanism or the superconducting locking mechanism are the ones quite frequently used.
So my question was, why did the magnet levitate over the piece of the copper? There are two videos showing that effect. In other words, there is a magnet on the top of the magnet that is levitating over the copper. And the copper interacts with that levitating magnet, so the magnet is not being pulled by the magnet on the top at a certain distance from the levitating magnet. The field of interaction, the forces of hold, that's what I'm interested in for you to explain. And to Jim.
Yeah, that first video of levitation where the guy has got this rather large copper box and you watch a magnet that's sitting on top of the copper box suddenly lift off the box, change to a different altitude, move around a little bit, and slowly settle back down. In my opinion, that was not a purely passive experiment. Inside of that copper box is a chunk of electronics. And
no, absolutely not. The guy explains how he did it. He put on the top of that magnet, he put another magnet. He was trying to pull that magnet from the copper sheet to that magnet that he was having on the top of it. That magnet wasn't shown on the video, but he stated it's there. Now, what is the forces that makes it happen over the copper and to exist?
This additional information about how he did the levitation, was that another video over the U.S.?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but both of them are alike, so you don't see anything new on it. My question is, what is the force that makes it magnet levitating over the copper bar and not being pulled by the magnet on the top of it? And to exist.
Hey, you said copper bar. I think you meant copper sheet or copper box.
But it was heavy, heavy piece of copper.
I think the copper would only have an effect if there was a changing magnetic field. You're bringing the big magnet closer or further away, making eddy currents. To my knowledge, copper, for a steady state magnetic field, has no effect. It's transparent. So other magnets in other locations, I think, were doing the levitation, but I'm not sure.
John?
KC2WGV. No, that I have no answer for. No idea what's going on there. It's kind of all hidden.
I give you some hints. larger little magnet, which is on the top of it. The weak diamagnet is over of copper is sufficient for holding the teeny cube magnet in a stable levitation position. And we're not dealing with eddy current in here. Levitation, but so we don't have a eddy current levitation, but they are magnetically stabilized levitation. The levitation is free and stable and needs no energy input. What you see is the eddy current damping when tries to misalign the floating magnet. So the levitation height is about 0.3 millimeters and much head is for the size of comparison. That's what I see from the explanation on the second video. And to
it. What you're describing, Wesley, is a very difficult balance to maintain for any length of time. So, over to you, Dick.
We're dealing actually with two videos. One video has a big magnet over the big chunk of copper. The second video is a tiny magnet, very tiny, 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter, NDFEBN52 cube magnet. Both or of them are being set up the same way. They have a larger lifter magnet on the top of it at a certain distance. But for some reason, that lifter magnet is not able to pull the smaller magnet, but instead of that is making a levitation. So, the vectorial forces, that's what I'm interested with, and the interaction of the magnetism and diamagnetism. Enter here.
By the way, the can you used, John, says Original Roast. Why'd you choose that brand name? Axel House. Oh, there it is. Very nice. Okay, I see the probe inside. And by the way, that's a very unconventional way to bring the probe in the center and then tilt it off to one side. If you can make that work, you try to tune that horn to what frequency? What are you getting so far, John?
Dick, it responds very well between 3.2 and 4 gig. And the reason that probe is tilted that way is if I rotate that can circumferentially, I can null out signals.
Yeah, I think this horn is primarily linearly polarized. And that's a nice frequency range you're using it over which. Okay, so you've got a nice round horn, linear polarization. Therefore, you can do a polarimetry experiment with this. You can measure how much H and V. You can easily resolve the difference between linear and circular and elliptical polarization with that thing. That's a nice, shiny inside. Did it come that way, or did you paint it, John? Go ahead.
No, Dick. I just cleaned it out and buffed it up a little bit, and same thing with the bottom of the can, just to make it look sort of presentable. But also, I did some experiments with it. I put carbon paper in front of it to see if it would attenuate signals. I put bags, empty Ziploc bags. I put bags of water in front of it. And I also took an anti-static bag, which I slipped over the vertically polarized transmitting antenna, and I got a 20 dB attenuation from that bag, believe it or not, at that frequency.
The bag slipped directly over the probe is going to detune the probe something fierce. If you were met...
No, it was over the transmitting antenna. The can is the receiver.
Okay, did you have a pair of these, one transmitting or one receiving? If not, what was the transmitting antenna?
Transmitting antenna was a piece of number 10 copper wire, stood up vertically, straight up, and it was approximately the same length as the one in the can, maybe a little bit longer. And that was right on the output of the generator. That was my transmitter.
So that is a quasi-quarter wave monopole. And the case of the transmitter was the counterpoise, is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay, you probably would be a little bit better off using another horn or building another one of these things. Now, when I think if I understand you correctly, when you put across the mouth of this horn your anti-static material, My guess is you saw very little attenuation when you did that. Is that true?
Yes, there's very little in front of the horn, but when I slipped it over the antenna, it went down 20 dB. Transmitting antenna.
I think I understand. Now, what you slipped over the antenna, what did it look like? Was it the silvery-looking anti-static bag, or was it the pink-colored anti-static bag? Over to you.
The silver-colored bag, and you can see through it. It's transparent, but you can notice that silver... it looks almost like a deposition on the bag.
Now, if you can put that monopole on the output of a vector network analyzer instead of on a signal generator, I think you're going to discover that when you put that silvery bag over it, the major mechanism by which you were attenuating the signal was impedance mismatch. I think it's a lot more impedance mismatch than propagation insertion loss. I think your monopole went from one length to some entirely different electrical length when you put that bag over it. Therefore, its visuar probably went to 30 to 1, if you know what I mean, John. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, that's something I could check out. I didn't think of that. Let's see, what else? I basically used all of the testing was the CAN as the receiver. I did some transmitting tests, but I had a question as the transmitter. That CAN has a lip approximately a quarter of an inch, which protrudes into the waveform in the center of the CAN. You can see that in a photograph, I believe. Do you think that has any ill effect?
Ill effect? No. Effect? Yes. Slight effect. It's changing the impedance of your horn, the equivalent electrical length of the horn. The first thing you'd want to know about is that if you take a ruler and you measure the inside diameter of that lip, how does that diameter compare to the cutoff wavelength of a circular polarized horn at your particular frequency? If that cutoff wavelength is a lot smaller than the length that you've got, than the diameter you've got, no sweat. If your lip starts approaching the cutoff wavelength, it's going to start having a rather large effect. It's not going to stop the signal. It's just going to create a significant reactance that has to be retuned out. By the way, because of the law of reciprocity, which horn you transmit and which horn you receive with does not matter. As such, if you really want to find out, the easiest way to find out how much impedance mismatch your silvery bag is creating, take a small chunk of that silvery bag, slip it over the probe inside of this coffee can horn of yours while measuring its visuar. There you're going to see that the majority of the attenuation is impedance mismatch more than attenuation, in my opinion. To really attenuate a signal, you have to put it into a completely six-sided shielded room where all the corners, where all the corners are making very good contact. That's one way you can stop a radio signal from flowing from point A to point B. Completely shielded with a six-sided box. Create a cavity around it. The other way is to absorb it, but you'd be amazed how difficult it is to absorb a signal. You know by way of the anechoic material you put on the walls of an anechoic chamber, the magram or whatever, it takes wavelengths of thickness of material to really absorb a substantial amount of signal. So does your silver bag fulfill the requirement for a six-sided, completely shielded box? No way. Does it fulfill the requirement for a multi-wavelength thick absorbing material like Amazon Cumming AN75? No way. The only other mechanism by which it can be killing the propagation is it's disturbing the living daylights out of the impedance match of the probe. I think that's what 98% of the effect is. I think if you, by one means or another, you put that plastic bag over that probe inside your coffee can and re-measure the standing wave ratio, you're going to say, holy blank, wow, did that change. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. I will try that. I also was bouncing the signal off of my fluorescent reflectors, and I could go around the room with that can. I have about a 1 meter length cable on there, and point it at different structures and read the reflected signal that was coming from the generator. Also, if you notice, the way that construction, I used one of those BNC connectors like I sent to you, and I can plug different size antennas in there, so it facilitates different frequencies.
Now, the BNC connector you mailed me, you're going to have to run that one by again, because I'm having trouble remembering it. By the way, when you point this can at your fluorescent fixtures, and you measure the reflection off of them, exact amplitude and phase angle, which you're eventually going to be able to do, and then you turn the fluorescent light on and off, where the fluorescent tube is a plasma being excited at 120 cycle rate, and when it's off, you're going to get a different reflection from the structure compared to when it's on. Wonder if you've tried that one yet, John. Go ahead.
No, I did not, Dick. That's interesting. I didn't even think of that. The BNC connector I sent you was a special one that we had used on a project. It was one you hadn't seen before. Standard BNC on one side, and no connection on the inside, but there was a little plug, and there's a piece of coax cable that gets plugged into that. There's a little jack on it. Do you remember that?
I must be foggy brain tonight. Right now I don't, but I will in an hour. This was TechNet number 1,402 of the series, and we're about to be cut off very soon. Now, this horn of yours is a beautiful looking thing. Looks like a lot of fun to play with. And by waving it around the room, if you're transmitting with this horn into a fluorescent reflector, and while the fluorescent light is running, and then you look at the reflection onto a good receiver and demodulate the envelope, I think you're going to see a significant 120 cycle component. If it's running on 60 cycles, or if you've got an electronic ballast, you're going to see a significant component at around 50 kilohertz. Over to you, John, KQRIW.
Okay, Dick, I will run those experiments. Sounds interesting, but it's been a lot of fun, and wasn't that hard to make, as you could see, and I learned a lot about it, and rotating that can with the vertical antenna, and as I could almost null it out completely. Very effective use.
Yeah, and to extend for a moment. Dick, I'm going to send you the material about the Schumann effect. I think it's exciting. Wikipedia about a trap electromagnetic waves, and they show the interactive V here. Extremely exciting stuff.
Saturday, and I'm on two different antibiotics.